Chief Judge and Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. Today, the McDonald Moot Courtroom at Cornell Law School has been transformed into a federal courtroom. Welcome to the sitting of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Today's case is United States versus Epps. Is the appellant ready for argument?
We are, Your Honor.
Is the government ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the amicus ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Appellant may argue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Stuckey, Senior Judge Efron, it's always a pleasure to see you, sir. Members of the court, always a pleasure to be here. As the court knows, we are here. First off, my name is William Casera. I am here along with my co-counsel, Captain Annie Morgan, representing the appellant, Captain Tyler Epps. As the court knows, we are here to decide two issues. The first of those is that the search of the appellant's personal bags exceeded the scope of the search authorization when the agent requested authority to search the appellant's person, his personal bags, and his automobile. But the military judge or military magistrate authorized only the search of the appellant's person and the automobile and did not authorize the search of the appellant's personal bags. As this court knows, the standard of review is whether the military judge abused his discretion under United States versus Leedy. The facts of this case are not terribly complicated. The facts of the case are terribly complicated. The facts of this particular issue are not terribly complicated. Yeah, this is definitely one of the more complicated cases, Judge Ryan. But the facts of this particular issue are not. Special Agent Cooper requested authority to search Captain Epps' person, his personal bags, and his vehicle. This is on AE1 at page 56. The military magistrate granted search authorization and allowed the search of Captain Epps' person and vehicle. There was no mention in the search authorization itself of his personal bags. So the agent asked him for permission for A, B, and C. The magistrate gave him permission to search A and C. He did not give him the permission to search B. And yet, the agent searched B and found the evidence that is in question.
Counsel, what did the government know when it asked for this search authorization?
When did they know?
What did they know?
That's a very interesting question, Judge, and not one that I'm sure I know the answer to as to what somebody else knew. But what I do know is that they knew enough to know that at least the agent knew enough that he wanted to search the personal bags. But the magistrate did not grant the authority to search the personal bags.
If he just asked to search the person and the vehicle, what would that do to your argument?
And then he searched the bags?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, it wouldn't change the argument in the sense
bags,
that.
The bags that were in reach.
Well, we don't know that they were in reach. The government didn't put on that evidence. They put on evidence that it was in a closet-like office. But it would certainly make the argument different. I don't know that it would make the argument less. But the fact of the matter is that in this particular case, they specifically asked for the authorization to search the bags, and they did not get that authorization. As you know, the Fourth Amendment protects the right to be secure in persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizure. MRE 315F, a search authorization must be based on probable cause. In this particular
Counsel,
case,
the government averts that none of the evidence that was found in the bags was actually introduced at trial, except for evidence that had already been found through other means. Do you agree with that?
We do not agree with that. And the fact of the matter is, yes, Your Honor. At trial, they had the burden to put that information on. They did not do so. The military judge, based on the evidence in front of him, clearly found to the contrary and said, this evidence that was found in the bag would have, or just evidence that was found in these searches, would have significantly affected the government's ability to prove their case. But respectfully to my co-counsel or opposing counsel, it is the government's responsibility to put that evidence on, and they did not do so at the trial level below.
Counsel, in terms of putting evidence on, was there any evidence put on by the government in this case on the merits of the charges?
None.
It's a pretrial agreement plea case.
It was a conditional plea, yes, Your Honor.
So, in terms of the evidence that the government had, what evidence was produced by this search which would have an impact on the guilty plea decision in this case? That is, what evidence was there that made any difference in this case in the context of a guilty plea?
Well, in the context of the guilty plea, Your Honor, the appellant's plea specifically provided that he preserved the right to appeal these matters, and as a result of that, the effect that it had was that once the military judge ruled against him on the search and seizure issue, that is what led to the plea. I'm not sure if that's answering your question, though.
My question is, if, for example, the material that was seized had no bearing on any of the charges and would not have had any relevancy to the case at all, where would we be?
That would be one of the factors to consider in terms of the inevitable discovery doctrine.
Right.
But the problem is that the inevitable discovery doctrine requires the, puts the burden upon the government to put that evidence on at the trial level. They failed to do so. So without knowing, and as we pointed out in our brief, the actual items that were seized were not copied and put into the record of trial. There's a listing of them in certain places, but the actual items that were seized were neither inventory nor put into the record. So we don't know, and it's their burden, and therefore the responsibility falls on them.
So you ask the question then a different way. Is there anything in the record which would identify whether any of this material was relevant to the decision of the, and I'm not asking for any confidential information, is there anything in the record that would identify whether any of that information would have been relevant to the accused's decision to plead guilty in this case?
The best that we have in the appellant's position is, in the appellant's opinion rather, is the citing of the military judge in a very somewhat generic sense that this information would have greatly impacted the government's ability to prove their case.
I thought that your position was that irrespective of whether the evidence was relevant or not, as long as the government exceeded the scope of the warrant by seizing it, if we made that decision, that whether it was relevant or not, that you got to withdraw the guilty plea because of the pretrial agreement.
Well, that clearly, I don't think that's contrary to what I was just telling the senior judge, Your Honor. He was asking me a very specific question. I agree with your assessment of our case, which is if we prevail on this issue, then the entire guilty plea is thrown out and he starts over again. That's the language of the guilty plea.
And that's if, even if all the things that were seized have nothing to do with anything.
That is the terms of the guilty plea, Your Honor.
So talk to me again about the interpretation of the word person. I understand your argument that because they specifically asked for belongings located within a reasonable vicinity of his person or as may be found at his work location, that since that wasn't included in the warrant, therefore that by implication the magistrate intended to exclude them. But let's say that those words weren't there and it just said the word person. And the person had appended to his had a backpack on or a purse on or a purse within like right next to them. Why wouldn't a person believe reasonably that was part of the person?
Had the search authorization not requested specifically the bags, and I think this is the question you're asking me, Judge. I want to make sure. Had the magistrate or the agent not specifically requested permission to search the bags, not been, I don't want to say denied or not granted that permission. In other words, if he had just asked for the person and the car, and the person is carrying a purse, and I think that's the Seventh Circuit Court case that the government cites, that I think arguably is part of his person. The problem that we have in this case is that they specifically requested separate permission and did not get that permission.
Why can't that clause, his personal belongings that may be located within a reasonable vicinity or may be found, be something that's just modifying person?
For two reasons, Your Honor. One is the fact that the agent requested the agent didn't think it was. The agent thought that it did not include his bags, which is why the agent presumably asked for specific permission to search his bags. That's one of the reasons, because the government, through the special agent, didn't think that it was. The other part of it is because the, excuse me, Your Honor, because there's nothing in the record of trial as to where those bags were located in relationship to the appellant. Again, something the government did not put in.
Closet-sized room.
Depends on, Your Honor, closets come in very different sizes. They could, you know.
Not the Pentagon.
Well, not the Pentagon. At my house, they do, Your Honor. My closet's very small. My wife's closet is very large.
You're lucky you live in your house, not the Pentagon.
Counsel, what does the record say What did the government produce or otherwise show in the record as to the size of this room?
Nothing.
As was indicated, closets come in different sizes, walk-in closets, small closets, then smaller closets than that. What do we know about the size of this closet?
Nothing. The government did not put on any evidence to that regard.
Counsel, could you please turn your attention to the issue of the search of the computer?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is your argument in regard to that issue?
The appellant's right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure from the Fourth Amendment was violated when there was no probable cause for the 7 December 2012 warrant. Once again, we are dealing with an abuse of discretion standard. Special Agent Armstrong requested a warrant to search the appellant's off-base residence for evidence of fraud to include, among other things, computer hardware, computer software, and digital media. And he gave several examples of that.
So from your perspective, what would the government have needed to do to ensure that the computer was properly searched?
The same thing that this court required them to do in Nieto, which is to draw a nexus between the items to be seized and the alleged criminal activity of the appellant. They did not do that in this case. Special Agent Armstrong did not say that he believed evidence of any offense would be found on any computer hardware that he defined, although he defined computer hardware extremely broadly. The Fourth Amendment protects people from exactly this type of search, the right to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable governmental intrusion, search, and seizure.
The government has at least some evidence, indication of travel fraud on a rather large basis, and it is essentially impossible to travel today without the use of computer. Are you saying that's not enough of a nexus?
Well, they certainly didn't put on any evidence of that. And once again, it is their burden, Your Honor. For somebody like myself, a fax machine may have been accomplished to use that. I'm somewhat dealing in the 20th, you know, I realize I'm 10 years behind the times when it comes
to
computers.
Let's go back to an earlier typewriters. If the request in the affidavit simply mentioned typewriters, where would we be? Or is it there's a question about travel? Search request is for typewriters. Would we have probable cause in the circumstance in this case?
I don't know enough about typewriter forensics to know whether or not you can determine.
Let's assume that typewriter forensics have two aspects to it. One is the form of the key, which can be discerned, and the other is the ribbon itself. Does the affidavit have to say, we want to see the key itself, we want to see the ribbon, or can the affidavit simply say, we want the typewriter, with the understanding that typewriters have keys and ribbons?
What Nieto requires is the agent to draw a nexus between the typewriter and the alleged criminal activity.
But here's the question. The nexus can be based on facts and inference based on facts, the facts and circumstances of a particular case, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Does that inference have to be written in something, or does it have to merely be inferable? Do you understand the question?
I do understand the question. The government put on no evidence as to what
but
the...
That's not my question.
No,
my question
I think I'm answering your question.
Do they have to put on the evidence,
yes,
or can it merely be inferable?
I think...
But because in Nieto, right, we said it basically that it couldn't be inferable.
Right. And I think that theoretically it could be inferable at the trial level if the military judge had made specific findings of fact, but certainly this court can't infer it at this point.
No. But we can say that the magistrate could have made the inference, that it was inferable, that they're asking for travel vouchers and travel documents. They talk about emails, and then they ask for a wide variety of computer equipment, right? Isn't it inferable that the documents were created on a computer?
It may be inferable that the documents were created on a computer, Your Honor. There is no way to infer that they were created on this computer. And in this day and age...
All I'm suggesting is it seems like the nexus that you're requiring is a lot closer and a lot more particular than the Constitution requires.
I think it's actually less than what Nieto requires. I think that Nieto requires more of a nexus than we are asking the court... Then we're asking the court to grasp in this case. In other words, I think this is a stronger case than Nieto, because in Nieto you at least had the evidence put on by the government, profile evidence, for lack of a better term, which one could then use that to infer that this person had these items on their computer. And this court said that's not enough. And similarly in this case, we don't even have profile evidence. We have, there is a computer.
Well, I would say you've got something more than profile evidence. You've got evidence of misconduct by the accused, specific to him. Nieto just is a profile, you know. One, I think, is a fortiori from the other. You're saying it's the other way around.
I'm saying it's the other way around, Your Honor, because I think what this court is requiring in Nieto is that the government draw a reasonable nexus between the item to be seized and the alleged criminal activity. In this particular case, they've said there is criminal activity. We want all of his computer work. And there is no effort on the government's part to put forth any evidence whatsoever to say, because we believe and we have evidence to show that he used this particular computer, as opposed to, you know, I learned last night you can use your watch to send emails now.
Again, going back to the typewriter example, does that mean for all the years that typewriters were the subjects of a search warrant that the government had to say, we know that there is a particular typewriter and that's the one that we want? Or could the government get a search warrant on the basis of, we have a typed document, we want to search the house for any typewriter that's in there?
If they have evidence that the document was created at that house.
Why do they have to have evidence that it's created at a house? Why can't they infer that if somebody types something, that it was typed from, that there's at least a reasonable probability, not a guarantee, that it was typed in their house? And similarly, why can't they infer that if somebody has typed something on a digital media, that it would be on a computer or other digital device in that house? Not a guarantee that it's in the house, but a reasonable probability that it's.
I think the answer to that question lies in the severe difference between typewriters and our digital age, Your Honor. The typewriters are not mobile. There is not a chance that he is going to, you know, to pick up his typewriter and bring it to the office and plug it into a peripheral at his office. There is a reasonable, there's every bit as good of a chance in our digital age that these documents were created at an office and they were created on a mobile device.
So then, Mr. Cacera, Chief, may I ask a question despite the fact that counsel's time is up?
Yeah, you may answer Judge Olson's question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Chief. In light of what you were just saying, if you are prohibiting any inference to be made, I know you're not in the business of doing the government's job for it, but how would the government show that there is any connection between a raft of printed documents and the computer that is in the home of the accused?
Your Honor, I actually thought about that this morning. Realistically, I'm not a police officer. I don't know what police officers do. I'm not going to tell them how to do their job. I know what Nieto requires them to do. And I believe that as it relates to forensic transmissions and digital transmission, it would at least require some reasonable probability, probable cause, reasonable probability, whatever term the court wants to use, between that document that was created and the particular computer that the government seeks to go into an individual's home and seize. Chief Judge Stuckey, my time is up.
Thank you.
Subject to any further questions from the members of the court, I will see you in 30 minutes.
Ms. Hardy.
Mr. Chief Judge Stuckey, may it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Chantel Hardy, and I am arguing as an amicus curiae in support of the appellant. This court should find that the searches of appellant's personal bags in his apartment violated the Fourth Amendment and that no exception to the exclusionary rule applies to evidence seized in either violation. First, beginning with the February 2013 search of his personal bags, this search exceeded the scope of the warrant, specifically authorizing a search of his person and his car, yet the agents searched his person, his car, and his bags after requesting authorization to search his bags and failing to get authorization. Now, this exceeds the scope of the warrant in a materially broad way, given that they first tried to get authorization to search the bags and failed to get authorization, and then they conducted the search in a way that they wanted to conduct the search rather than conducting the search that they are authorized to conduct. Now, while a warrant is not required in all cases, there needs to be some type of exigent circumstances or some type of exception to the warrant requirement in the Fourth Amendment.
address my question, which is basically why can't the term person as used in the warrant be understood to have included the clause that basically followed the term person in the affidavit?
Well, Your Honor, first, the term person can, for example, include things that they're wearing at the time of a search. However, here on these facts, we don't have facts that he was wearing the bags. We have a location of the bags in relation to his desk. And second, as we see from the application for a warrant, the officers enumerated what they were requesting to search. They didn't search his person and then passively mention the bags. They enumerated one, Epps's person, two, Epps's personal bags, and three, Epps's vehicle. So that shows an awareness that the bags were not a part of the person or could not be a part of the person if they didn't ask specifically for what they wanted to search. Given that they didn't ask and given that they weren't authorized to search the bags, this court should not find that that search was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment.
Does it appear from the record how close the bag was to his reach? Or do we just have the statement about the closet-sized room?
Your Honor, we only have the statement about the closet-sized apartment, but as appellant argues, that doesn't necessarily give us any information as to how big the office was.
Assume for a moment that the bag was not attached to him, sitting on the floor, sitting on the desk, but that he could, you know, stick his hand out and touch it or something like that. If this were a search incident to arrest, could the bag have been searched for a weapon?
Yes, Your Honor. If this was a search incident to arrest, then the immediate vicinity language which came up in the lower court would matter. And anything within his immediate vicinity would be able to be searched because the officers would have a need to search things within his reach to make sure that the officers are safe when they are conducting that arrest. Mm-hmm. However, the immediate vicinity analysis is improper here and is mistaken because given that this was not a search incident to arrest, that language and that search, the search of his person does not expand to his immediate vicinity.
Okay. Would you go ahead? When you started, I think you were getting toward good faith and inevitable discovery. Would you discuss either good faith and or inevitable discovery with relation to the bag?
Yes, Your Honor. First, in discussing the good faith exception outlined in Leon and Shepard and outlined in the military rule would not apply here. The good faith exception applies where you have a valid or an invalidated warrant that the officer acted on in conducting a search. Here, we have a warrant that neither party has argued is invalid. We have a valid warrant on its face and based on the affidavit that it applied for. The warrant did not incorporate the affidavit, and no one is arguing that the warrant was invalid in any other way. We have officers, on the other hand, conducting a different search than the warrant authorized. And that wasn't what the good faith exception outlined in either Leon Shepard or in the military rule was created to catch. The good faith exception was created to include evidence that an officer seized or searched off of a warrant that he believed to be valid at the time that he conducted the search, and then a court later, for some reason or technical reason, invalidated the search warrant.
What about inevitable discovery?
And for inevitable discovery, Your Honor, the government has the burden of showing inevitable discovery, showing affirmative steps that they were taking at the time of the illegal search, and that something without the illegal search would have led to the same evidence. And as this court pointed out in Wicks, the government has to not only show that they were making affirmative steps, but they have to show that it would have been the same evidence. So in Wicks, this court talked about the text messages in that case, that the government couldn't show that it would have seen the same exact text messages through affirmative steps of their own.
Counsel, I'm sorry, Judge Ryan.
Well, I was just going to ask whether you had a view, a response to my question to appellant's counsel about whether if the language in the affidavit merely said person and car, what would your view be as to whether person included the bags in his immediate vicinity?
Your Honor, in my view,
in light of the fact that warrants are to be construed like generously, right? They're not supposed to be narrowly construed because there's a preference for warrants.
There's a preference for warrants and they are not supposed to be construed with technical scrutiny. However, The analysis would not change in this case because if the warrant authorized a search of his person and his bags and the facts, the other facts.
Person and car.
Or the person and his car and the fact that the bags were next to his desk at the time, again, the analysis wouldn't change as to whether or not the bags were a part of his person. The only time that the bags are going to be a part of his person based on the case law is if they are on his person or if this is a search incident to arrest and they are in his immediate vicinity. So whether or not they had asked to search the bags, the analysis wouldn't change based on that hypothetical.
Counsel, thank you, Chief. The military judge made a finding that the inevitable discovery doctrine did apply. This court owes that military judge's finding deference, do you not?
Yes, Your Honor.
So how do you get past that deference that we owe the military judge's finding?
Well, Your Honor, if this court does view conclusions of law de novo, so even if you or some deference, you would still look at the conclusion of law. And if you see that the court erred in its conclusion of law, then you would move from that conclusion.
But what do you base that on?
I believe that is from...
No, I mean, I agree with that's legal standard. What I'm saying is, on what basis do you say that his conclusion of law was erroneous?
Well, because, Your Honor, as this court stated the standard in Wicks about what the inevitable discovery doctrine requires, I believe the lower court applied a looser standard for the inevitable discovery doctrine. And here, I don't believe the government has shown on this record that they have met that burden that this court outlined in Wicks for that doctrine.
Counsel, doesn't the record reflect, and correct me if I'm wrong, but on the inevitable discovery issue, that on the 8th of December, they conducted an interview with the accused, right? And he allowed a consent search of some bags he had with him at that point, didn't he?
Yes.
Now, and I think they found some items of evidentiary value in the bags that they searched.
Yes, Your Honor.
I guess my question is, between the 7th or the 8th of December and when the 5th of February search takes place, don't they have reason to believe that if he has bags with him, that they probably have evidence of value to the investigation contained within them? In other words, by the time they got to 5 February, they had a lot of evidence that they had accrued and collected with regard to their investigation, I think. And so what I'm asking is that had the illegality not occurred with respect to the bag on 5 February, and they had confronted the accused on 5 February and had seen the bag, is it reasonable to think that they would have simply stopped then and noticed that, hey, look, we searched him before when he had bags and we found items of value. Wouldn't this bag have ultimately or inevitably have been searched and the items contained therein been found? Do you know what I'm asking? That's a long question. But let me give you a short one. I'm saying, hey, look, if the investigators show up there and confront him at this closet or whatever it is, and they see that he has bags with him, or a bag, and they know that at a previous time they searched him when he had bags and they found evidence of value, would not they have done the same thing? Had the illegality not occurred, wouldn't they have simply said, hey, look, we know we searched him before when he had bags and we found something. Isn't it reasonable to think that he's got something in the bags this time? And wouldn't that bag have ultimately been searched? That's the question.
Mr. Chief Judge, may
you may answer the question.
Well, in that instance, Your Honor, with the first search, even though they searched the bags before, they had consent to search the bag. So there would need to be some legality to allow them to search the bag. So even if the illegal action didn't occur and they saw the bags and they met with Epps at this time on February 5th.
I'm talking about a reasonable inference. Like, I mean, couldn't they have assumed that, hey, look, he has a bag with him. It probably has evidence of value to our investigation given what they were investigating. You don't think that there's a reasonable inference that they could have stopped and searched that bag?
Your Honor, no, that's not the standard. They still would have had to have some type of exception to the warrant requirement in order to search those bags. For the inevitable discovery doctrine.
You're saying that would have been inevitable, right?
It would not have been inevitable.
All right, Your Honor. I just want to know what you're arguing about.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Kubler, and along with Colonel Julie Pidvorek, I represent the United States in this matter. On 7 December 2012, the search of appellant's residence was well supported by probable cause. At the heart of the issue, it boils down to the fact that there's more than a fair probability that long-term wedding planning takes place in one's home, and that's particularly true where it involves fraudulent activity.
Can you speak up? Well, I'm having trouble understanding.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
On 5 February 2013, the search of appellant's bag was appropriate for three reasons. First, at the outset, this court could recognize that there was nothing found in the appellant's bag that OSI did not already have or was not in the process of getting.
Well, how do we know that?
Yeah.
We know that
largely through the testimony of Special Agent Long and through his affidavit that broke down every step of the investigation. They had obtained all of his defense travel records, all of his.
But I mean, shouldn't the government have like neatly lined up? This is what was found. This is where it was already extant. In the government's possession. I mean, isn't that what you need to show? And there's no place that need even tidy, is there?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that with respect to the travel vouchers, it is neat and tidy because Special Agent Long laid out that he first requested every travel voucher that the accused had filed, covering all claims. When he realized that the electronic travel vouchers didn't cover the full field, he then requested every one that was manually filed, and he got that from the Air Force Services Center. Then he got every government travel card record and had the comparisons made. And then because he realized there were discrepancies right away, he had the finance office compare the receipts from each of them and subpoena all of the business records, thus gathering hotel receipts and flight information and comparing them against those records which he filed.
Do we know whether these flight reservations were made on DTS or not on DTS? Or some yes and some no, or what do we know about that?
Yes, Your Honor, we know that they were made in two ways. Because the appellant in this case traveled in different ways, he would have filed manual travel vouchers, which is why there are two requests that needed to be made. First, on 19 December 2012, Special Agent Long and his affidavit on JA 175 and JA 995 discusses how he requested all the Air Force claims involving Air Force funds. Those would have been the electronically filed ones. On 4 January 2013, he then requested every manual travel voucher that was filed by this appellant, and that's in the record of in the joint appendix at 996 and at 176. And he made that request from the Air Force Financial Services Center. And so he had every travel record that this accused had filed. To further answer Judge Ryan's question about the neatness of the evidence as put forth by Special Agent Long, he then asked one of his coworkers to run a FinCEN check, and it quickly became apparent that there was a FinCEN.
Financials.
Yes.
But what did they do about the military judge's finding on the record and when they were discussing the plea agreement, right? And the fact that this was a contingent plea agreement, contingent on the right to appeal these particular Fourth Amendment violations, alleged violations, that in his opinion, that the government would have needed some of the evidence that was found during the searches in order to prove its case.
Yes,
and
Your Honor.
He did make that finding, didn't he?
He did make that finding, but he did not make that finding with respect to any specific search. He made it with respect to all the searches. As Frank Spinner was arguing, he said that the motion to suppress involved about 12 different searches. And the judge at the conclusion said
he made it with respect to all the searches. Well, which way does that cut?
To me, Your Honor, the way that cuts is that if none of the evidence was admissible, the government wouldn't be able to proceed, obviously. However, if certain aspects were suppressed, such as in this case the search of the bag, where nothing was found that OSI didn't already have, then it was inconsequential. He wasn't specifically addressing that search when he made that statement. Looking in the record, what he was talking about was after all of the motion practice was done and the conditional guilty plea went in, he said if the government lost this motion, meaning in toto, that it would have had a hard time going forward.
Well, except so the government's position on the bag is basically no harm, no foul, because it had everything that was in there anyway.
That's
because the government certainly goes to a lot of trouble arguing some other stuff.
Yes,
like
sir.
It was really part of his person.
Right, yes.
Yeah, you know, what is the government's, to quote the late, great James Baker, what's your best argument? What's your best argument on the bag?
Your Honor, all of the above would be our best argument.
No, but is the fundamental argument the government's making that the bag was so close that it was almost appended to his person? Or is the fundamental argument the government's making is no harm, no foul, because we had all this stuff anyway?
I think both of those are true.
But what's your best argument?
Yeah.
Like, let's just cut to the chase. Is your better argument that person includes things that aren't the person? Is your better argument that this was his person because it was close enough? Or is it that it doesn't matter because we would have inevitably discovered anything that was in the bags anyway? I'm not asking you to concede that the other two are garbage.
Yes, Your Honor. If I only got to pick one, I would pick the one that I started with, was essentially that everything that was within the bag, OSI already had. That's the clearest and simplest.
They already had it at the time of the search, or that they already had in mind that they were going to get something like that?
They already had it, for the most part, at the time of the search.
Not for the most part, is there specifically, did they have every item that was in those bags at the time of the search?
They either had every item or they had subpoenas outstanding to receive those items. And I can break down the different categories. You know, with respect to the travel records.
So the answer is that no, at the time of the search, they did not have every item. There were some items for which subpoenas had been issued.
They don't have to have had it for it to be inevitably discovered, right?
And I'm unaware, correct, Your Honor, and I'm unaware.
I'm trying to find out what the record shows in this case at the time of the search.
Yes, at the time of the search, they had all of the travel documents and they had begun subpoenaing all of the flight information, hotel information that's associated with that. That's in Special Agent Long's affidavit.
And is there anything that was turned up in the bag that was not the subject of a subpoena to a third party?
There were envelopes in the bag from the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. That seems inconsequential. There was nothing of consequence.
Seems inconsequential. Those envelopes couldn't have been used by the government at trial.
They were not, and I don't know what the utility of them was, Your Honor.
Are you saying that as a definitive matter, they have no utility and it was harmless?
Or that what about the medicine label?
The medicine label, Your Honor, amphetamines were not charged, and the government was already in possession of the electronic evidence that, first of all, they were in possession of the prescription forms, the blank prescription forms, and they were actively seeking electronic evidence
did
with respect to.
Did the government disavow at trial that they would make any use of those records?
No, Your Honor.
So couldn't those records have been used for purposes of either support or impeachment during the trial?
It's a possibility.
And could the defense then have determined that it might not be in a position to contest at trial if they had to face that evidence, at least with respect to those charges?
Yes, that is.
And how can we say that those are harmless, those items that were not inevitably discovered as a result of a subpoena?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because, I mean, their argument is, even if it doesn't fall, if it wasn't inevitably discovered and it was in the bag, right, and it could have been used, and it's evidence that based on their pretrial agreement, that they can withdraw their pleas of guilty to everything. Explain why that isn't true. Right, so let's use the medication label reading amphetamine salts, right? You didn't charge him with possession of a fraudulent medicine label for amphetamine salts, right? But you'd agree that that's an evidentiary item of it's evidence. It's arguably evidence of a crime.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and it would not have been discovered but for the search of the badge, would it?
Correct, Your Honor.
So, given that it's in the government's possession now and would not have been but for the search of the badge, why don't they get to withdraw from their pretrial agreement? I mean, I'm asking.
Yes, and
because I understand your position about the inevitable discovery of many of the things.
Yes, Your Honor.
But what do we do about the things that are not inevitably discovered that are evidence of a crime?
Your Honor, with respect to the amphetamine salts, I didn't have, the government didn't have any information that this was of a criminal nature, but it's a fair point that I don't have information one way or the other, to the contrary. Moving on to the other position, which was that the search of the appellant's person encompassed the bags.
Can I instead put your attention on issue number two?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why couldn't the government's argument be distilled down to this when it comes to the computer? If computer-generated documents are evidence of the instrumentalities of a crime, then the government has the authority to search all electronic devices of an accused.
And that, I agree with that, Your Honor.
So why isn't that frightening? Why shouldn't everyone sitting in this courtroom be frightened by the fact that the government is arguing if computer-generated documents are either evidence of or instrumentalities of a crime, the government may go into every single electronic device of an accused?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's analogous to if we know that there's a knife that's used in a crime, we're allowed to search every drawer that can contain that knife. Or if we know that a document has been typed by a typewriter, we...
But wait a minute. When you're talking about this knife example...
Yes, Your Honor.
If someone uses a knife in the course of attack, you're equating that with the ability to go into a kitchen drawer, with being able to go into someone's computers? Not sure where that gets the government.
Well, we know that there's a digital evidence that was created. Essentially, these travel orders were
created. But why couldn't it be just as likely, if not more likely, that an individual has used a work computer, internet cafe, library, something like that?
Right. There is a possibility that he did that. The question here is whether there is a fair probability that the digital devices in his home contain that. And we believe that this is a lot stronger than United States versus Nito in the fact that we don't have, in Nito, I think the court was faced with a problem that a crime was committed potentially on a cell phone. And the question was, what evidence do we have that crime left the cell phone universe and made it onto a laptop? And they didn't have anything to
establish. But what is the nexus you're drawing to the home computer of the individual?
First of all, the probable cause wasn't merely about digital evidence. It asked for papers, records, and orders as well. And it was that the accused had done 6 months of wedding planning, all of which was fraudulent. In the affidavit itself, it discussed several things. And I would say duration is one of the factors that we would say if the appellant, and we know it was the appellant, who was personally engaged in this wedding planning with the hotel, making representations that this was an official government function, sending 6 months of emails back and forth between the hotel, providing his coworker with a falsified travel order. This ongoing fraudulent activity for a period of 6 months, I would say that time period alone says that there's a fair probability that long-term wedding planning occurs in one's home, that we're going to find this in his residence.
Hadn't they conducted a search of his shared office earlier and found some evidence?
Yes.
And I think your point might be that it is then reasonable to believe that there's nothing else at the office, that it must all be at his home. Is that a reason? Jump to make or a nexus to make?
Yes.
You didn't make it in your brief, but I'm wondering.
Yes, I think so. I mean, that's not the entire universe of the wedding planning by the groom, and so it would be there. Additionally, recency weighs in favor of it being there. The appellant at this point, when the search was conducted, still had not returned from his honeymoon. So any papers or records or evidence that would likely still be found there in the home. A third factor that was in the affidavit and before the military magistrate was the fraudulent nature of this. Not only was that the fact that these things were fraudulent, but it was before the military magistrate that this individual was a law enforcement agent, that he was an OSI agent. And so one would think that as he's generating these false documents, having these conversations and making representations that his wedding is actually an official government function, it would be more likely done in the privacy of his home rather than in a shared workspace with his law enforcement coworkers.
My question that I asked appellant's counsel, which is, all this is fine, well, and good. It's none of it's in the affidavit, right? These inferences aren't in the affidavit. So my question is, do they have to be in the affidavit, or do they just have to be inferable?
I understand what you're saying. We can say
it's a reasonable inference under the circumstances, and is there a case that says that the magistrate has to have the inference has to be drawn, that the dots have to be connected, or the T's crossed in the affidavit itself, or does it just have to be a reasonable inference?
I don't have a case that supports that, but the government's position is that it has to be inferable, that the information from which the military magistrate could make these inferences has to be there. And our position is it's clearly there with the discussion of 6 months of email and the other information, although not, as you said, expounded upon, or the lines hadn't been connected or drawn out for the magistrate. There also was a meeting between the magistrate and the OSI agent who had brought this affidavit up.
Counsel, with respect to the remedy, and not asking you to concede that there's error, but assuming that there's error in this case and it's not cured by any of the exceptions, do you agree with the defense that the remedy would be to set aside findings and sentence in this case?
Meaning that he gets to withdraw his pleas of guilty, like it says in the pretrial agreement.
If there's error and it's prejudicial for either of the searches, then I would acknowledge that it would be hard to argue to the contrary.
Okay, so if this court orders that, does the court also have to address anything with respect to the pretrial agreement? That is, does the pretrial agreement stay in effect? Is it automatically avoided? Or does the accused get a choice as we hear it? What happens if we set aside the findings and sentence in this case? Can the government prosecute the case again?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe they could.
And is what happens to the pretrial agreement at that point? Can the accused maintain the pretrial agreement, or is it gone?
I believe it's gone, Your Honor.
The accused doesn't have to affirmatively withdraw it?
I'm not certain, Your Honor.
Okay.
With respect to the laptop, I would also point out that in my review of the record, it appears that the government, the laptop that was found in the appellant's home on 7 December was a GTAC laptop, which appears to have been a government laptop, which has a lowered expectation of privacy. And so that could also be considered. If you look at JA-300, that's where Scott View mentions that it's a government laptop. And then JA-935, there's some of his analysis that shows that there's a consent banner. The actual MacBook Pro was seized on the 8th of December, which is a different scenario. We believe there was more than enough probable cause to seize the evidence on supporting the search on 7 December 2012. In addition, just very briefly, the search of appellant's person, we believe, was reasonable. The narrative that the defense is putting forth, that they had asked for A, B, and C and only been granted C, is kind of different because, first of all, the warrant asked for...
Wait a minute, you're talking about the search of his person? I don't think that's an issue.
I'm talking about the search of his person, Your Honor. When they are discussing how they asked for the ability to search the car, the person, and the bags, and Judge Ryan's question was, what if they hadn't asked about the bags? Would that change the equation? And I believe it shouldn't change the equation just because they had asked for it. At the end, at paragraph 17, they had actually asked for the ability to search the person in the reasonable vicinity around him. I believe this agent believed that he had the authority to do so. In fact, it's important to note that unlike many cases where the agent asks the judge and then the warrant gets returned, may I briefly conclude my answer? Yeah. In this case, the individual who wrote both the 1176 and who wrote the affidavit was one and the same, was Special Agent Cooper, and he's the one who executed the search. So reasonably, he believed that when he was asking for it, what he was authorizing in the 1176 gave him the ability to search those bags.
What is the 1176?
The 1176 is the search authority.
Okay.
Done by the military magistrate.
I have one Judge Ryan question has one to question. Ask you. There's a report of investigative activity that lists what was found in the search from 5 February. Do we have a listing of what was found from the December search?
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you just tell me where that is in the day?
If you look on page 798 and on page 804 and 805.
Thank you.
And I would just note that number two, it's crossed out and it's hard to read on the side, but it says not seized, only monitor. So okay. The only computer that's there is actually the government computer.
Okay, thank you.
Judge Sparks, of course.
Lieutenant Colonel Cooper, how do you answer, you seem to be arguing with regard to this 5 February search that the agent was relying in good faith on his belief that he had the authority to search the bag because it was part of his person. How do you answer the amicus counsel's claim that, well, wait a minute, good faith only comes into play when you have an invalid search authority or search warrant? And in this case, no one seems to be disputing that it's a valid search. You seem to be arguing that he had a good faith belief to mistakenly rely on a valid warrant.
Yeah. May I answer, Your Honor?
Oh, yes.
So we're arguing two things. First, that actually it was authorized that this was covered
in
the warrant.
I'm narrowing it to her point
right.
About this good faith reliance thing.
If this court were to find that that it doesn't cover the bags, then we would say the warrant was defective in that regard because the 1176 was defective because it didn't cover what he was seeking to.
Then you're saying that the magistrate has to just copy it or something?
Well, the magistrate, the form was actually typed by Special Agent Cooper and signed by the magistrate.
Well, I don't care if God typed it.
Fair enough, Your Honor.
You know, what are you arguing? Are you arguing that, you're arguing, I think, that it was error to leave the mention of the bag out? Or what are you arguing? The magistrate has to,
we believe that the
by rote, regurgitate what he's given in the affidavit?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Judge Efford had a question.
Paul, it's related to that. I believe on 782 of the joint appendix, the government argued at trial that it was a mistake that the reference to the bag was left out. And my question is there anything in the record that would tell us whether this was a technical, clerical type of mistake, or whether it was a deliberate decision on the part of the magistrate to leave out the reference to the bags. We know that it happened, we know the assumptions that are people making about that, but in the record itself, is there something that would tell us whether this was a clerical type mistake or whether it was a deliberate decision by the magistrate?
And, Your Honor, the closest that we have to that is the fact that Special Agent Cooper, the individual who wrote the affidavit, is also testified on cross-examination with Frank Spinner that he was the one who typed out the 1176 form for the magistrate to sign. So in that regard, we would say that it's objectively reasonable that it was a clerical error that he didn't include what he was asking for if this court finds that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Does the appellant have rebuttal?
We do, Your Honor. Thank you.
Counsel, so why isn't the government correct when it comes to the issue of the computer? The government says what was going on here is a long-term fraud where he was engaging in wedding planning and so forth, and so that it's certainly a reasonable inference that he would be using the computer at home. And so that is why it was permissible once you had these computer-generated documents as evidence of instrumentality of the crime to search the home computer.
Your Honor, as my opposing counsel was arguing that, I was staring at that little gray thing on my desk, which is a Surface Pro computer. A wonderful little toy that I probably don't know how to use 90% of it. But one of the things I do know is that I can send and receive emails from anywhere in the world on that computer. The reason why we cannot make a reasonable assumption that the travel documents were created on the appellant's home computer is because they could just as easily have been created on a Surface Pro, a Mac, a iPad, or any one of the numerous other devices that one can use in creating these documents. Secondly, Your Honor,
that doesn't make it not reasonable that it could be on the home computer. It just means it could also be on other computers.
It could be on thousands of documents. That's what our thousands of mechanisms.
Well,
that's
that,
why this
under
court.
Under that argument, you wouldn't ever have reasonable probability to search a computer.
We would, Your Honor.
Because it could be on some other computer.
Your Honor, I'm quoting the exact language of Nieto, in which it says, for probable cause, and I think I'll leave this answer to the Chief Judge's question as well, and your question, Your Honor, which says, a sufficient nexus must be shown, not may be inferred, must be shown to exist between the alleged crime and the specific item to be seized.
But in that case, we said that that none had been shown because there was no nexus that could be inferred under the facts of that case.
And I am saying that in this case, there is none that can be drawn because you can't infer a nexus in this case from his home computer as opposed to any of the other electronic devices.
So, counsel, are you saying that there is no nexus that can be drawn, or are you saying that the government failed to spell out that nexus?
In my brain, they're the same things, Your Honor. In other words, that this court can't draw that inference because the government has not provided them evidence to do so.
Well, let me ask it differently then. Could the government in this situation have, in the affidavit, spelled out the nexus, going through what the government talked about in oral argument today?
I don't believe they could have, Your Honor. I believe that what was required is for them to do.
So going back to a question I asked you in your first argument, I realize that you're not in the business of supporting the government, but building on a question that Judge Ryan asked, how would the government, we're talking about reasonable inferences,
right. How
would the government ever be able to show that there is a direct connection to the home computer of any accused?
Well, for example, in this case, Your Honor, they could have gone into the Air Force, theoretically, one would presume, and the government didn't put this evidence on at trial, so that's why we are somewhat hamstrung answering that question. But they theoretically could have gone into government travel records and gone into government computers.
They didn't put the evidence on at trial because your client pleaded guilty. I mean, the concern that I have, counsel, is that throughout your, or at least in several places in your brief, you say that there's no evidentiary support about this nexus, which is very different than a reasonable inference, right? A reasonable inference does not require evidentiary support. It's an inference. It's like the difference between direct evidence and circumstantial evidence, right? Which is, can you make the mental leap?
But the problem, Your Honor, with
in addition to the standard of review that we're looking
no,
at this under,
I understand
which
that, Your
benefits
Honor.
The government.
But understand, Your Honor, obviously from the way that the flow of the trial goes, the government was obviated of that burden when the appellant pled guilty. So the egg came after the chicken, so to speak, because by then we already had a guilty plea. So.
But you understand my point.
I do.
You can't blame them for not putting on evidence when your client pleaded guilty. You're right. That relieves them of the burden of putting on evidence.
And when I say put on evidence, Your Honor, I'm speaking of the 39A suppression session, not during the trial on the merits, obviously, because at that point it's overcome by events.
Counsel, could you address the remedy issue, whether this court needs, first of all, what does it mean to set aside with respect to the status of the agreement?
Your Honor, as we pointed out in our brief, the appellant's position is that the pretrial agreement, if he prevails on, as like JA 1016, if he prevails on further review of appeal, I will be allowed to withdraw my guilty plea. That doesn't mean he's required to. It believes that it says that he is allowed to.
And what's the government allowed to do at that point? If he withdraws his plea, government proceeds. Can the government reinstate the two charges that were withdrawn? Is there any limitation on that?
I can, Your Honor, I can tell you for certain that the government can retry him. We don't dispute that. As it relates to those two charges that were withdrawn, I honestly just simply don't recall if that was conditioned upon the plea. If it was, then theoretically they certainly could.
And if they withdraw that, those two charges, my recollection, have a 5-year sentence on each. Is the government permitted at that point to seek a sentence of 20 years in this case?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because the case law is clear that, putting it in a lack of a better way, that the appellant can do no worse on appeal than he did at trial.
Is that only true with respect to the charges upon which he was convicted? That is, if additional charges are added, doesn't Article 63 permit the maximum to be increased?
Your Honor, I hate to leave a question hanging, but the honest truth is I did not foresee that question. I don't know the answer. I'm happy to provide supplemental briefing if the court so desires.
I'll leave that to my colleagues.
I understand. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court, Chief Judge, that concludes our presentation.
Thank you, counsel.
Always a pleasure, Your Honor.
The case is now submitted. Argument has been concluded, and the court will now recess in place. The clerk will recess the court, following which there will be a brief Q&A session from the gallery.
The court is now adjourned until further order of the court.